Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president-elect continues to put his team together as
the refugees are welcome here. No.
President Obama trying to reassure Americans as these protests continue across the country. A prominent African-American journalist has died after battling cancer. Also, I had a break from politics with a couple of movie reviews. It's all on today's International Edition. A protest continue in at least seven cities across the United States following the stunning election of Donald Trump. These protesters in New York City chanting Donald Trump, no fear, refugees are welcome here. Thousands of high school students also walked out of classes on Monday in protest of the election. And in his first interview since being elected, Donald Trump was asked by Leslie Stahl of CBS's 60 Minutes what he thinks of all the fear of his presidency.
I want to ask you all about something that's going on right now around the country. A lot of people are afraid. They're really afraid. African Americans think there's a target on their back. Muslims are terrified.
I think it's horrible if that's happening. I think it's built up by the press because, frankly, they'll take every single little incident that they can find in this country, which could have been there before, if I weren't even around doing this, and they'll make it into that event, because that's the way the press is.
And President Obama held a press conference on Monday where he did try to offer reassurance.
I had been encouraged by his statements on election night about the need for unity and his interest in being the president for all people, and that how he staffs, the first steps he takes, the first impressions he makes, the reset that can happen after an election, all those things are important and should be thought about. And I think it's important to give him the room and the space to do that. It takes time to put that together. But I emphasize to him that, look, in an election like this that was so hotly contested and so divided, gestures matter. And how he reaches out to groups that may not have supported him, how he signals his interest in their issues or concerns. I think those are the kinds of things that can set a tone that will help move things forward once he's actually taken office.
Well, Obama said he's leaving the country in better shape than it was when he took power in 2009, when the economy was on the verge of depression and there were a huge number of fires to put out. He said Trump will have the time and space to make judicious decisions and that the famous Trump temperament will not serve him well at certain times. The president said those who oppose Trump have to recognize that this is the way democracy works. He appealed to them to let him make decisions, saying the American people will judge if they like what they see. The U.S. presidential election did take Europeans by surprise, as leaders in France and Germany in particular are expressing concerns over what will happen to their relationships and agreements with the United States under a Trump administration. Joining me now for that part of the story, Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
Well, the first reaction was pretty much one of disbelief. It had really been felt here that Hillary Clinton was going to be elected the next president of the United States. The first real reactions came from right across Western Europe, with leaders all talking about the enduring long relationship between European nations and America. That was the instant response. Once it actually sank in, you started to see different reactions coming. For example, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, she wrote a letter to President-elect Trump setting out what Germany expects from its future relationship with the United States. And she was very clear about that. She was clear about what great value the Germans put for people of different races, people of different cultures, for the respect for basic human rights. So that was really quite a firm assertion by Angela Merkel of that. The French president also was very clear. He said that France does have a very long relationship with the United States, but that there would need to be allowances made on both sides for the relationship to continue in a constructive manner. On the actual problems ahead for Europe and the future Trump administration, what they're looking for really is some sort of signal that a future President Trump will go along the same lines as Europeans thinking on key matters such as Russia, Syria, Iraq, NATO, and particularly Iran. Now, the EU feels very strongly about the Iran nuclear deal. The European Union worked hard in that case to broker that deal. They feel that there's a lot at stake, and the United States can't walk away from that. When it comes to Syria, you have to remember that the United Kingdom, France, and Germany really did defend the Syrian opposition, and they have been continuously calling for President Assad to step aside. So when they hear Donald Trump talking about the possibility of doing a deal with President Assad, they don't like that. Other issues which are very important to the Europeans, and particularly the French, is the Paris Agreement, that global climate accord which was signed here in Paris. That was meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and provide a more secure future for the generations to come. Now, France is really attached to that, and so are the Germans, and they don't see and don't want to see any pulling back from commitments that the Obama administration made to that. When it comes to NATO, you're seeing a far tougher line. The Secretary General of NATO, which is a 28-member alliance, he has warned that it's not going to be easy for Europe if the United States decides to go it alone. And in a really very harsh criticism of Donald Trump, the NATO Secretary General pointed out that Article 5 of the NATO Charter, that article which calls for all members to take up the cause of another member if they're attacked, that the only time that self-defense clause has been used is when it was in support of the United States after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. On top of that, the NATO Secretary General said that NATO members would be very confused, would be very, what he was describing as, uncertain if they saw America pulling away from NATO, because at least 1,000 European soldiers of the NATO alliance have died in Afghanistan as part of that operation that was in a direct response to the attack against the United States. So on that level, NATO is very concerned. But there's also a lot of talk, particularly between France and Germany, on the two countries using this threat of a more insular-looking America to build up their own defense cooperation, to have a sort of a broader European military integration. And in fact, one German member of the European Parliament, Manfred Weber, he said that perhaps this is going to be the wake-up call that will force Europe to wake up, and that 70 years after the end of the Second World War, perhaps Europe should be looking at its own defense force and really just making sure it is safe, and to start thinking again about having a nuclear defense, a nuclear deterrence that is not so bound up with the United States.
In other words, another arms race?
That is what they're desperately hoping will not happen. But certainly that could well be. When you look at some of the European policies towards Russia and you put them alongside what a future President Trump has said about Russia, yes, you could be looking at an arms build-up, particularly when it comes to the Baltic states.
And what about the Russia factor?
This really matters big time. When you look at the real problems that Europe is facing at the moment, and you see it, you have Iran, you have Syria, you have migration crisis, and you also have uncertainty in the Baltic states. At the heart of that is Russia. Russia has always cast a very big shadow over Eastern Europe and over Central Europe, and particularly in Germany. You see and you feel so much more when you're in Berlin, the closeness that part of Europe has to Russia and the concerns there, that really Germany, if it doesn't play its cards right, it could be alone in standing up against Vladimir Putin and the Russians.
What about ordinary citizens there? What are they feeling?
Two very different threads coming through. One is they just can't understand it. Media here was always saying it was going to be Hillary Clinton, and then suddenly there's about turn, and it was Donald Trump. Other people weren't quite so surprised, because you are having in Europe at the moment the same sort of populism is coming to the fore, the same sort of far-right movements that are having successes in some of the elections that are being held, whether it's in France, Germany, or in Austria, that these far-right parties, which are pretty much saying the same type of message, these movements, these waves, are just as strong here in Europe as some of the, and it really does equate with some of the remarks that President-elect Trump has been making. There is a real fear. There are people who are saying that for 70 years, Europe has depended on the United States to secure its freedom, to secure the economic prosperity of Europe. And without that, of course, is fear. No one knows what's going to happen.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Here in the United States, reported hate crimes against Muslims rose in 2015 to their highest number since the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And the watchdog organization that monitors hate groups, the Southern Poverty Law Center, is reporting about 250 hate crimes since Election Day. Joining me now for how the Muslim American community is reacting to the election of Donald Trump is Dawood Waleed, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you for being with us, Dawood. What are people in your community feeling about what's happening?
The American Muslim community as a whole is feeling like other communities of color and minorities at this time, which is a great amount of concern as far as where our nation is actually heading in a new era of Donald J. Trump.
What are some of the biggest concerns?
Well, there are short-term concerns and long-term concerns. So the immediate concern is, prior to Mr. Trump even being inaugurated, there's been an increase of hate crimes all throughout the country against communities of color, including Muslims. And according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, from Election Day until Saturday, there's over 200 reported incidences that are, post-election hate that have taken place. So that's very concerning. And that's just right now. God knows what's going to happen after the inauguration. But the long-term consequences are the policy concerns, the concerns of mass rounding up of immigrants through immigration custom enforcement, the issue of revisiting the Muslim ban, where many of our family members and friends may not be able to get visas to visit Muslims, get citizenship, and also the increasement of mass surveillance against the Muslim community, which is already a reality that started during the Bush administration.
How worried are people? Are they feeling emotional? What do you say to those people when they express their concerns to you?
Well, what I've been telling people in the community is that we need to take the proper safety precautions for ourselves, protect our families and our institutions, but we need to also be prayerful that, this is part of God's plan and God is in control, and we don't know the ultimate outcome of what's going to take place. So we need to be security conscious and prayerful. But in that regard, there's a third component that we need to join other concerned Americans and be involved in organizing for positive change, that we want to see our country take a different turn away from the hateful and divisive rhetoric that has been taking place during this election cycle.
And you mentioned the uptick in hate crimes. I know you are in Michigan, and something happened there. Can you tell us what that was?
We've had more than one incident in Michigan. The latest one was a female student at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, not too far from campus, was approached by a white male, and the threat was made that if she did not take off her hijab, that he was going to put her on fire. So she complied, and right now campus security is working with the Ann Arbor Police Department in investigating that. We're hopeful that if anyone knows any information, they come forward, and that the Washtenaw County prosecutors, if this individual is caught, that he is charged under the ethnic intimidation law that we have here in the state, because from our vantage point, this is a clear hate crime.
If we wanted to summarize this, is there a plan of action within the Muslim community to deal with some of these concerns at this point, or is it a wait-and-see approach?
Well, tonight we're actually having a teleconference with the more prominent Muslim leaders throughout the country. I plan on joining that call, and there's been a number of things that have been discussed about a plan of action about where we go from here. But the primary concern is, how are we going to keep our institution safe, as well as people who are visibly Muslim? And the most the people who are most at risk right now are Muslim women who wear the hijab.
Dawood Waleed, Executive Director of the Michigan Chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. Mosul civilians are telling of execution, beatings, fear of the future. Three Somali Americans are sentenced for plotting to join IS. A climate envoy says the Paris deal will move forward even without the U.S. And global internet continues to become less free. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, Gwen Ifill, one of the most prominent African-American journalists in the United States, has died after battling cancer for months. She was 61 years old. In 2009, Ifill wrote a book about President Obama called The Breakthrough: Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Here she is at a town hall forum last year asking President Obama about the campaign of Donald Trump.
I first want to ask, by talking to you a little bit about this campaign, what do you think it means when you hear the words, "Let's make America great again"?
I think America's pretty great.
Well, the president, during his Monday news conference, made a point to mention Ifill's passing.
On a personal note, Michelle and I want to offer our deepest condolences to Gwen Ifill's family and all of you, her colleagues, on her passing. Gwen was a friend of ours. She was an extraordinary journalist. She always kept faith with the fundamental responsibilities of her profession, asking tough questions, holding people in power accountable, and defending a strong and free press that makes our democracy work.
Well, Ifill moderated the 2004 vice presidential debate between Dick Cheney and John Edwards, and then the 2008 vice presidential debate between Joe Biden and Sarah Palin. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all, from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Let's check in with G. Abby Lee to find out what's trending on social media. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori.
So what's going on?
Hashtag Supermoon is a worldwide trending hashtag, and you can find photos of the brightest moon in 68 years all over the web. That's when the moon becomes full on the same day it's closest to Earth, so you see it really up close and personal.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm. Where were the photos taken?
So I'm not sure if the curated tweets are based on the user's location, but for me at least, the photos were mostly taken in the United States. Fox News shared a photo of the moon rising behind the U.S. Marine Corps War Memorial. and the U.S. Department of Interior shared one taken at a ranch in California.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So what about personal accounts of what people are seeing?
Unfortunately, not very many. You can detect a supermoon with your own eyes, of course, but you can't capture it very well using most smartphones. And, you know, that's how most people take photos these days.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So this tweet captures the disappointment and frustration people felt. When you can see supermoon but don't have super lens.
Yeah, I get that. So what else is trending?
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and his cat.
Cat?
Mm-hmm. He has been holed up at the Ecuadorian embassy in London mm-hmm. for the past 4 years, as you know. And during the time, he got a cat.
What?
I know.
Really?
I mean, in my opinion, that's a good use of her time.
Well.
Incidentally, the cat has a Twitter account at Embassy Cat. Swedish prosecutors visited him at the embassy on Monday over rape charges. But, Lori, the big takeaway from the meeting was that the cat was wearing a tie. Twitter users are saying if Assange dressed up the cat to take attention away from the prosecutor's visit and questioning, it was an incredibly silly move, which worked.
Wow, okay, yeah, we're talking about it. So
that's
what does the cat look like?
Judging by the photos shared on Twitter, the cat was wearing a red and white necktie and looking out the window.
Okay, well, we all love animals here. Mm-hmm. So anything else?
The mannequin challenge is in full swing. I don't know if you heard about it, mm-hmm. but it's when a group of people try to act like a mannequin by holding a position still for a long time. And it looks like gymnasts are doing it much better than most of us. I mean, understandably. And you can find the proof on Twitter. Lori?
All right. Thank you so much, G. You can follow her at G Abby Lee. You can also follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, let's turn to some lighthearted fun here. Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard is joining us for his latest movie reviews. Jeff, to start off, you've got a suspense thriller starring Amy Adams. What's that about?
Well, we have another alien invasion movie. But this time, it's not coming in guns a-blazing, or should I say lasers a-blazing. These mysterious aircraft, these spacecraft, touch down all over the Earth. And they're positioning themselves over China and Russia and the United States and Europe. And so when you think about if we really, really were visited by advanced beings, who would you send to talk to them? You know, obviously the military would go, but this time we have to send a linguistic expert. You know, we have to learn how to communicate with them. And Amy Adams is one of the top linguistic experts of the world, and she's brought in to investigate along with Jeremy Renner. So these creatures are communicating through these symbols. So she spends the next couple of months in this spacecraft trying to figure out, you know, what is their intentions? What are they doing here? Are they friendly? Or are they not? And, of course, the military is very interested in what they're doing here. And Forrest Whitaker plays a Colonel Weber who's like, look, we got to find out what their intentions are because the Russians want to attack them and the Chinese want to attack them. So, you know, this is not a big kind of movie. It's more like Contact. Remember with Jodie Foster?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like an art house cinema style to it. This is from director Denis Villeneuve, who did French director, who did the really good movie called Prisoners, you know, with Hugh Jackman, and also Sicario, which is one of my favorite movies of last year. Unfortunately, what he does is he tries to, you know, it's really kind of a complicated, slow-moving kind of movie in terms of it gives these symbolism, and I don't want to give away any spoilers, but the whole third act of the movie, you know, we keep getting these hints of what the aliens are doing here. But again, like I said, it's an art house cinema. It's kind of like a real cerebral science fiction. And usually I kind of appreciate that, but the whole feel of the movie just kind of leaves me empty. So I know a lot of critics are going crazy for this movie. It's got like a 95% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but I didn't feel that formula worked. He was experimenting with the story, and I can't tell you what he did without ruining the movie. But ultimately, it's like, why are the aliens here? That's the big twist, you know, very Sixth Sense kind of ending. So a lot of people are enjoying it. I didn't enjoy it, so this is one of those kind of things where, you know, I'm on the wrong side of everybody else.
And then we've got a drama, Moonlight. That looks interesting.
Yes, this is like one of the most celebrated movies of the year in terms of all the film festivals. And this is a coming-of-age movie about a young boy in the 1980s in a rough neighborhood of Miami, growing up with a young black child, going from childhood to adulthood. He struggles to find his place in the world while growing up in just the toughest neighborhood you can think of, with drugs and there's gang activity, all kinds of things. And what the director did is that he took three different actors to portray his life, you know, as a child, as a teenager in high school, and then as an adult. And he's not only dealing with, you know, his mother, who's, you know, a drug addict, and also trying to, you know, get his high school diploma and trying to make something of himself, but he's also dealing with his closeted homosexuality. You know, so can you imagine being a gang, you know, a drug dealer in a gang and being gay in the 1980s? You know, of course, you know, you've got to suppress that. So a lot of people suspect him. So the movie has got such a human connection to this. This is one of my favorite movies of the year. And not only is it just a beautiful movie photographed and the music and the just incredible performances. And again, you have three different actors who play Chiron, who's the main character throughout the film. So this movie is going nationwide now this week. And you're just going to hear everybody talking about the film, especially when it comes around to award time and the Academy Awards. They're not going to forget this movie because it's unlike anything you've ever seen in terms of a coming-of-age movie. I really, really encourage you to see this movie.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last month, two newly elected pro-independence lawmakers in Hong Kong, Sixtus Leung and Yao Wai-ching, changed the language of their oaths of office. The Legislative Council barred them from assuming their seats. Hong Kong's judiciary took up the matter to decide whether the two would be able to retake their oaths and assume their office. Before the Hong Kong court handed down a decision, China's top legislative body issued an interpretation of the basic law that in practical terms said no second chance would be allowed. The matter is still with the Hong Kong judiciary. China resumed the exercise of sovereignty over Hong Kong in 1997 under the One Country, Two Systems framework enshrined in the basic law, which vests in Hong Kong executive, legislative, and independent judicial power, and also protects the rights and freedoms of the residents of Hong Kong, including freedom of speech and association. Regarding the recent developments relating to Hong Kong's Legislative Council, Deputy State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States is disappointed.
The United States strongly supports and values Hong Kong's Legislative Council and independent judiciary, two institutions that play a critically important role in promoting and protecting the special administrative region's high degree of autonomy under the basic law and the One Country, Two Systems framework that have been in place since 1997.
We urge the Chinese and Hong Kong Special Administrative Region governments and all elected politicians in Hong Kong to refrain from any actions that fuel concerns or undermine confidence in the One Country, Two Systems principle, said Mr. Toner. Hong Kong's prosperity and stability depend on the successful implementation as provided for by the Joint Declaration and Basic Law, We believe that an open society with the highest possible degree of autonomy and governance by the rule of law is essential for Hong Kong's continued stability and prosperity as a special administrative region of the People's Republic of China.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.